Hello, thank you all for coming. Thank you. This is Banjos at Dawn, the first episode, and it's part of the Writer in Residence programme. My name's Sally O'Reilly, and I am the Writer in Residence. And I've devised this format because, well, there are two types of public speaking that I want to avoid. One is that kind of sycophantic, oh, isn't everything, oh, I like what you just said, I quite agree. There's that model, and then there's the let's all pretend we're talking about this one issue, but then all just take it off to our own areas that we're all usually quite comfortable at speaking about, and it's all about us. So I don't imagine you two necessarily gravitate towards that anyway, but the format is such that that can't happen. But first of all, I should say that Banjos at Dawn, this is number one, and number two will be in December. This one is presented in collaboration with Art Monthly to mark the imminent reprint of their Interviews on Art publication and the gestation of the second volume of Similar. And the next one is in collaboration with Third Text, and it'll be on multiculturalism in the arts, which sounds a bit hot potato-y. So, here's the format. Okay. Now, the tradition is with dueling that first up is a reverse alphabetical order of surnames. So, Gilda will present first. So, sort of 10, 15 minutes, although you're going to define some terms as well. Okay, so we're all going to know what we're talking about from the off, and then Gilda will take that on to present her position for the interview. So this is all for and against the interview. So Gilda first, and then Julian Stalabras here. Well, I haven't introduced you, have I? Sorry, that's outrageous. shall I do that? I'll do that, sorry. Gilda is an art critic and lecturer, and I don't know much about which books you wanted to introduce into.
Well, I did the five series of monographs, which is something like 50 interviews in there, and collected a book called Press Play. So that, in terms of interviews, is probably a pedigree I might like to bring up.
And Julian Stalabras is a writer, curator, photographer, and lecturer, and a reader in art history at the Courtauld Institute of Art. And has written such books as Art Incorporated and Internet Art Online, The Online Clash Between Culture and Commerce, and High Art Light, Gargantua, so some quite broad survey books, and writes regularly for Art Monthly and Tate and New Statesman. Ah, so, sorry about that. That was really rude, not introducing you first up. So, where was I? Oh, yeah, the structure. So, Gilda presents your position for the interview. Julian is going to present his position against the interview, but without responding directly to Gilda's position. And then, Gilda, if you come back in and take issue with Julian's position, and then, Julian, you come in and take issue with Gilda's. Okay. And then, from that point onwards, the two speakers up here have seconds in the audience. And as is a tradition, the seconds can be brought in from this point onwards to speak for you. So if you want to pull them up at some point in time where you think it would be useful to have a new voice on your side, you may do so. Or seconds, if you feel moved at any point to chip in from that point onwards, please do. And then after that, it's an open bun fight for all.
Okay.
Is that clear?
Shall we introduce the seconds as well?
I think they're anonymous usually.
Oh, they're anonymous.
They're sort of the somber, okay. Anonymous face of some sort of authority. Okay, so over to you, Gilda. Thank you.
First of all, thank you, Sally, for the invitation. Thank you, Julian, for being my worthy opponent in this. The artist, I'm going to start with some defining of terms because I think that's rather crucial here. So the interview is one of the many forms of art writing that are sort of proliferating. They are monographic texts, reviews, artist writings, etc. And one of these is the interview. I'm going to mostly be concentrating on the artist's interview, which is a text. Okay, so I'm not really talking about YouTube stuff. I'm talking about a text. For my purposes, that probably will broaden as the discussion goes on, between two people, one of whom is an artist. Okay, two of them can be artists. The first person can be a critic, but they can also be a writer, philosopher, etc. And of course, we all know that this model, this very conventional model, has been riffed on in every possible direction, right? Multiple voices, round tables, mock interviews, and artists interviewing themselves, a critic interviewing themselves, the in-conversation model where there isn't really a Q&A, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're probably going to look at all the ways that we've tried to get over the sort of conventional model of the artist interview, often originally with a critic. So that's mostly what I'm talking about. Although I'm well aware of the many, many, many variations on that. It seems to me also that the interview was sort of invented for mostly to serve kind of four purposes, okay? And I might add most of which are in crisis, which I think is why we're having this debate right now. One is a kind of fact-finding exercise, okay? What did you do? When did you do it? Where did you show that first? What's it made out of? Et cetera, et cetera. All of which is, you know, artists forget, artists say the wrong things, deliberately, not deliberately. Whether we believe that is another issue. There's an idea of some kind of access to insider talk, okay? That what do these guys talk about? What is the artist like? What's the critic? What do they talk about when they're sort of behind closed doors? There's that, however much we might now imagine that's kind of a fiction, and we know more and more that that is a fiction. There is the illusion or the sort of fantasy of that kind of access, which I think is still as seductive as it ever was. There's also the idea, and probably the thing that's the most in crisis, which is the artist will help you read or understand the work, that there's some kind of primacy in the information or the motivations or the sources or the images, etc., behind the work that only the artist can reveal, and that is somehow going to enrich your experience of the work. And I think most of us probably indulge in this, even though to some extent we know that there is that's been very much challenged, whether those kinds of intentionality is even worth considering. And the fourth one, by the way, which needs to be considered, is the interview as performance. Okay, so it's part of an artist's practice. So the Andy Warhol interview would be the most typical, where he just stands and it's a performance. He just says yes, he just says no. He's not really having an interview. It's part of the practice. And we all know the artists for whom an interview is very much a performative thing, like Jeff Koons or like Gilbert and George, Tracy Emin, etc. But there's others, I think, that are more subtle, like Brian Gander, say. Are his interviews really part of his practice? Arguably, yes, even if it's less spectacularized. So those, to me, seem why the interview was invented in the 60s in art, and why we sort of stick with it. Now, why is these ideas incredible? The interview, for those reasons, because it could do those four particular things, it seems to me, it had a special status in art. Okay, it has a special status among the types of art writing, which is at risk. And what I'm going to look at is why and how it's lost that status and how it can possibly, in the moments that it can, regain it. We are all aware of the interview as a fiction. Okay, we are all aware that artists know that they are being taped, that they're not necessarily themselves. It's re-edited, it's reworked, they take on voices, et cetera, et cetera. And we also question the need to sort of locate the artist behind the work. We question that sort of idea of subjectivity within the work, et cetera, et cetera. So why do we still love interviews? And I know I do. Okay, my first reaction when Sally said, would you defend the interview, was, of course, everyone loves interviews. That's like, I've got the easy side of this debate, right? They're easy. The language is easier. It's fragmented. If you want to do something hard, break it up into pieces. Most interviews are broken up into pieces, okay? The language tends to be easier. There's the fiction and the seductive fiction of eavesdropping, of a conversation. It's like novelists who break up a story by adding dialogue. It enlivens things. However much we might know that it's a false enlivening, it still makes it rather more pleasurable, often though not always, than other types of reading. Certainly if I get an art magazine, the first thing I read is the interviews. If I get to the rest of it, that's great, but I may not. And if I'm doing research on an artist after seeing the work, the first thing I will look for is an interview, and it's the first thing I will read. So why is that? And we can all think of dozens of great interviews that we know and love. Like, for me, the interview Warhol did with Benjamin Buchlow in 1985, which I'll get to, which is a masterpiece, which is just completely revises my understanding and my thinking around Warhol almost despite itself, despite being a failed interview in many ways. So there's also the thing that doesn't go away, which is that something emerges that's bigger than the questions and the answers. Okay, something, some kind of some other text that comes outside of the question and the answers that is not predicted. Some third kind of result comes out of that pairing, however it might be kind of worked on. And that is really quite exciting to me, and I think that still works. That by way of introduction. I'd like now, if I may, to read not an artist interview, but the beginning of The Interview with the Vampire by Anne Rice from 1976. The vampire says, "I would like to tell you the story of my life then. I would like to do that very much." "Great," said the boy. He quickly removed the small tape recorder from his briefcase, making a check of the cassette and the batteries. "I'm really anxious to hear why you believe this and why you..." "No," said the vampire abruptly. "We can't begin that way. Is your equipment ready?" "Yes," said the boy. "Then sit down. I'm going to turn on the overhead light." The vampire moved towards the table and reached for the overhead cord. I'm cutting a little. At once the room was flooded with a harsh yellow light, and the boy, staring up at the vampire, could not repress a gasp. "Dear God," he whispered, and then he gazed speechless at the vampire. The vampire was utterly white and smooth as if he were sculpted from bleached bone, and his face was as seemingly inanimate as a statue, except for the two brilliant green eyes that looked down at the boy intently like flames in a skull. The boy shuddered, lifting his hand as if to shield himself from a powerful light. "Now," the vampire asked, "do you still want the interview?" Now, the reason I bring that up is it's an important date, actually, 1976. It's the year that Avalanche magazine ended. Avalanche magazine being, as you know, the sort of legendary magazine that came out of New York from 1970 to 1976, which was comprised solely of interviews, rather miraculously, a series of great interviews with the great of mostly conceptual art around that period. It's the year that Interview magazine, Warhol's Interview magazine, really took off, went from being underground to being mainstream. And then I think it looks at an idea of the interview that is the original idea of the interview, which is in crisis, which is that a figure who has not spoken in a very long time, for centuries, vampire artist, is now, technology has given them the chance to talk, okay? And they are able to reveal something that no one else has known until then. They can give their side of the story. And this is how the interview really began. It was a very, very political kind of thing, all right, to allow the artist to have more control, a kind of transparency about what they are doing. And it was a place where that kind of instability, all right, the one that I think is in here, where the expectations are completely turned upside down, can be staged. Now, I'd like to admit that that kind of model is no longer possible. Okay, in art, because I think I could read you examples from Avalanche, but maybe we'll get to that. I think we should look at more recent examples. I don't want to go over the good and the greats from like the 60s and the 70s. I'd like instead to read you an interview between Maurizio Cattelan and Peter Coffin from 2007. Okay. So it's an artist interviewing an artist, and Peter Coffin is very much the subject. It's still Q&A, okay? It's not really that other kind of in-conversation model. Cattelan says, "Should we challenge existing conventions of art that limit how we think about and make art? What do you think is important about how artists are working today?" Coffin says, "The value of a particular artist after Duchamp can be weighed according to how much they question the nature of art, which is another way of saying what they added to the conception of art of what wasn't there before they started." He goes on like that for another three sentences, okay? And Cattelan says, "Well, what is the truth? How should we be true artists?" Coffin says, "Thou shalt be the messenger of freedom. Thou shalt fight conformism, reinvent life. Thou shalt give thy love. Thou shalt grab the soul, give something back. Thou shalt have a sense of purpose." Cattelan says, "Really?" Coffin says, "Well, I don't necessarily agree with everything I say." And Cattelan says, "Okay, well, what's a good working method? Do one thing at a time. Know the problem. Learn to listen. Learn to ask questions. Distinguish sense from nonsense. Accept changes as inevitable. Admit mistakes. Say it simple. Be calm and smile. Is this how you work? I like the idea that even as I sleep or play, the work is moving towards its completion." Now, what we have there is a ventriloquism, right? Kaufman is totally aware of the fiction of the interview, and he is putting on all these different voices. He puts on the voice of the dutiful artist and art student. I know my Duchamp, I can talk the talk, here I go. He puts on the voice of the Bible, right? The sort of the voice of truth, some other kind of holy truth. The voice of the sort of managerial newspeak thing, you know, do one thing at a time, all that. And then he takes off the mask to probably reveal another mask, which is the one, well, I don't really say, I don't really, meh. You know, he kind of sort of is, now he's going to be himself, which again, we doubt. But the thing that is interesting about this interview, and I think it's a good interview, in my opinion, is then he kind of stops playing games, and he gets to something about what he thinks an artist is, what an artist does, and what he's after. And he says, I really feel there's a kind of dialogue of imminence, that certain questions become demanding and potentially answerable, and that everyone involved on a particular level of asking questions, whether a physicist, a philosopher, an artist, is essentially involved in asking the same questions. And if at some point we look at the world and feel that things are not resolvable by logical thinking, we have to develop an antithesis. And that's really what contemporary art is in our culture. It's an antithesis. Now, I think that's kind of an interesting idea in and of itself, whether spoken by an artist or not, that there's a post-Enlightenment moment outside of logic that the artist can be thinking about. And what's interesting to me is that the interview still is a place where that instability is so there that an artist is willing to start doing crazy things like defining art, defining what I do, defining what art is. And when I started looking at a lot of interviews for this exercise, I noticed how many artists are willing to go out on a limb and start doing the kind of things you could never do in any other kind of writing, which is really ask very big questions, like, what is art? Why are we making this? Okay? They're terrible questions. We're too embarrassed to ask them. Wiener says in an interview, 97, I'm just an artist. I don't have to be right all the time. I'm not giving out medical prescriptions to people. I'm not fighting an airplane. Flying an airplane, I'm just this person putting things in the culture, and that thing can change the culture. Or Linda Benglis, this is an issue of Frieze, arrived on my doorstep this morning. The artist is always dealing with the bounds of the material in the unbounded nature of the universe and of the imagination, and trying to mark the time. Now, these are big things. It's very hard to find a place in the art world where you can start grasping at something big. And one last example, Dennis Cooper, interview with Tom Friedman that I edited, actually. They're talking about the purpose of art, and they're laughing about it, because you have to laugh about it. And Tom Friedman, Dennis Cooper says, well, but ultimately you believe it's important. And Tom Friedman says, I don't know. I think in terms of ideals. If I were to think about what the ideal art would be, that would be an art that gives viewers an experience that they take with them, and that causes them this incredible revelation, which they, as enlightened people, turn towards society. They would do these amazing things that penetrate other people, who then all come together, and we live in harmony, and there's peace, and we're all transcendent individuals. It sounds like a comedy, he says. So under this cloak of the interview, where he can change voices, where he can start with, I don't know, and then sort of move into it, and then get silly about it, okay, and work with hyperbole, which is very hard to do in normal language, in prose language, he can change voices and actually start going out on a limb, which is really hard in other places, I think. And there's ways that kind of instability that was there all along can be used, whether it's through humor, whether it's through really listening, whether it's through testing ideas, and where the interview is not a shortcut. I think that's what the interviews become. Sometimes the interview is kind of like a spoken press release, really, and those are depressing. But it's okay. I mean, it's kind of a waste. Why not just write it, then, you know, transcribe and so forth? There's sometimes that an interview is really just kind of, these are the ideas the artist was looking at to make the work, which it can be useful, not necessarily something I'd want to champion. I think, and this is my last point, if I've gone on too long, if we look at the history of the interview and think of it as part of an overall, a bigger idea that's now kind of losing its ground about de-skilling, right? The artist was de-skilled, the interviewer was de-skilled, the critic was de-skilled. Anyone can put a mic underneath somebody's mouth and get an interview. Whereas the interview is actually a really, really skillful thing. And it needs to be prepared probably as much as, in fact, as much as any long, serious text. It needs interesting and varied language like a good text. It needs beginnings and middles and ends. It needs a thesis. It needs ideas that are brought into the discussion and that are, and what it has, what's particular about the interview is that those ideas are actually tested with the artist, and those ideas are actually kind of become alive rather than just sort of expressed. And so I think that kind of where the instability that we first was there in the interview, that we still kind of love and we're still seduced by, where the interviewer is so skillful to bring that out, I think it still is works and is worth championing. That's
Thanks.
My intro.
That's a good case for the interview. Did you want to show the Warhol clip?
Well, just for fun.
Yeah.
All right. This is interviewer's performance at Uber.
Andy, do you feel that the public has insulted your art?
No.
Why not?
Well, I hadn't thought about it.
It doesn't bother you at all, then?
No.
Well, do you think that they've shown a lack of appreciation for what pop art means?
No.
Andy, do you think that pop art has sort of reached the point where it's becoming repetitious now?
Yes.
Do you think it should break away from being pop art?
No.
Are you just going to carry on?
Yes.
Okay, Julian, do you want to come straight in for against the interview? Yeah. I'll just put your PowerPoint up.
Thanks.
Oh, hang on, sorry, it's already open.
Great, thank you. Okay. I think it would be silly just to be against the interview, and I'm not going to be just against the interview. I've done some of them, for one thing, some of them with artists, and I've been interviewed many times myself. And Gilda has laid out the case for them very eloquently, I think. We get enjoyment from them, we get insight from them. There's something about, you know, that they're a public dialogue, and there are all virtues of that. There's the accessibility and informality of the interview. So you know, what could be wrong with interviewing? I guess what gives me a certain kind of pause are two things. Firstly, their dominance in art discourse, which is, you know, a historical matter. It's not always been the case. So that might be something we ask questions about. And then their general character. Now, Gilda has laid out for us towards the end of her talk, I think very eloquently, you know, the ideal of what the interview could and should be. But if we look at the reality of the regular run of the interviews that we read, I think a rather different picture emerges. There are some problems that all interviews, I think, have. And this is especially true if we're thinking about the interview as some kind of idea that we, you know, gain access to an insider discourse or to some sort of truth. There's firstly just the general unreliability of memory, of which there's a great deal of work being done. So certainly anything which deals with retrospection, we should be extremely suspicious of, I think, when we're talking about participants. I mean, you know, there's a lot of very convincing work, for instance, that you take your current views and you map them back onto your past self. And there have been good long-term studies of people, you know, revisiting their student years, for instance, and being asked about their political opinions, and really forgetting entirely, and they're not lying necessarily, but forgetting what their early opinions were, what their early perspectives were, and simply assuming that there's much more kind of cogency and coherence in a sort of life trajectory than there really is, okay? So this is something that, you know, we all do. Then, of course, there's the issue of honesty in various ways. You know, people lie. They lie a lot, especially about things that really concern them. There are things which may fall short of lies, but may be kind of propagandistic statements. Okay, things which are designed to... statements which are designed to alter a reality. You know, many politician statements fall into that kind of category. They're sort of a form of speech act in a sense. They're not quite a sort of formal speech act in the Austin sense, but they're. I don't know how many of you have seen or remember the Phil Silvers show, you know, where he plays Sergeant Bilko. Bilko's statements are almost always like that. They're kind of statements which transform reality around him and trying to seek to change everybody's perceptions. It's perfectly clear that in many cases Bilko doesn't believe what he's saying, but he manages to convince everybody else that the world around them is different than they might otherwise imagine. And as such, all of these things are also an exercise of power. And I think that's something, you know, it's very perfectly clear, of course, to politicians, but I think it's true of many interviewees as well, that what you have here is a rather unequal setup, often. Of course, there are exceptions, but you have somebody, you know, seeking access to a supposed truth from somebody else. So it's immediately given the kind of special status. And in that case, these sort of forms of speech acts and propaganda and perhaps lies are exercises of power. So I think we should treat all interviews with a certain amount of circumspection, but I think that when it comes to artists, we have another set of particular problems which you can kind of load on to these general ones. So there's one, I think, comes out of the sort of cultic celebrity, which is also another historically contingent matter, which surrounds many artists today and which has led some critics, like Isabel Gror in her recent book, to describe artists as a sort of celebrity, you know, the kind of founding celebrity in a sense. And it's certainly true that there are a number of the most successful artists live their lives very much in the media. And here the interview form, of course, is sort of crucial along with the profile. There's a general sort of coziness of the interviews that are generated out of this. And they come across and are fundamentally a form of promotional literature. And as such, I think, you know, we should be extremely suspicious of that and of the status of any statement that's made within them. And then we have the sort of over-dominance of the interview, in a sense, and the overproduction of these things. The fact that they so much dominate what passes for critical discourse about the arts. One might think about Hans-Ulrich Obrist's various productions, you know, sort of monumental productions of interview books, and his marathon interviews that he conducts with all these figures. I was going to say something about his personality, but I think I won't actually. But if you've seen these interviews or seen videos of them or read them, you'll be aware of the kind of interview that they are. He's well prepared, I think, in that sense. He meets one of Gill's standards, but there may be something about a certain kind of maybe it's a product of the overproduction of these things, that perhaps there's something that he's not always in total sympathy with his subjects, I think. Maybe a good or bad thing. I don't know. So there's overproduction as well, and I say the dominance of these things. Then again, there's artist statements are not quite like politician statements or the statements of other people in interviews. They have a peculiar statement. They often come across as somehow ineluctable or unchallengeable, particularly within the way in which, you know, especially well-known famous artists are treated in critical discourse or in what, as I say, what passes for it. I've been looking at the work of Jeff Wall lately, and he's a very interesting case, I think, in this. He wrote many very intelligent critical pieces about photography and conceptual art in particular in his early career. He's been interviewed many, many times. And this sort of discourse of Wall's forms a kind of block which it seems extremely difficult for people who write about his work to move around. In the catalogue Resonne, the cover of which I'm showing you, many of these texts are reproduced, and they're called primary texts, which I think is very interesting. So any statement by Wall is a primary text. Any statement by anybody else is a secondary text. Now, the issue of what constitutes a primary text in the study of contemporary art is a rather delicate and interesting one, and One would have thought in some ways that, you know, contemporary art criticism is all primary. Okay, but I think so it's an ideological naming this of Wall's text. But perhaps what's interesting is that we can see the work and these texts as part of a unit. They're all, in a sense, part of the oeuvre. And the remarkable thing about this is that Wall has, of course, many art historians, very prominent art historians, who are his supporters. And they very frequently cite these texts as if they're the kind of gospel, they're the touchstone. All right. So if they're seeking to make a point, very often they'll go back to Wall's writings and interviews and make this point. But if you read these things, Wall changes his mind really radically, right? Especially, I mean, you know, over political issues, it's very, very striking, from really a kind of Adornian, bleak, kind of leftist, melancholy elegiasm in his early writings, through to something really quite conservative in his later ones, right? And one where, you know, that kind of leftist view is entirely disposed of. And that kind of trajectory is not often referenced, and you can, you know, these critics will, and his art historians will reference a text from 1978 and another text from 2002 as if they're the same thing, right? So there's something very strange, I think, as I say, about the ineluctability in the way in which interviews are often handled. So I think that they are dangerous in a certain way, and that they can harm critical discourse. I think that's one of the problems. And in Wall's case, I think what you have is a real kind of defamation, in fact, of the writing around him. He's very successfully managed to sort of bend the writing around him in a particular direction. He actually did a PhD. He started a PhD at the Courtauld Institute. And his in part his study was about Marcel Duchamp, who of course was another master of this, making textual interventions to determine and overdetermine perhaps the interpretation of a work. Okay, so there's that. Then of course there's the issue that artists are interested parties. Stephen Farthing, who used to be the master at the Ruskin School, once told me, and it was this something that stuck in my head, I guess. He said that artists are liars, cheats, and scammers. Well, this may be a slight over-exaggeration, but I think it's very different from the way in which, you know, one would normally think about artists. So, plainly, as Gilda has said, there's a lot going on in the interview which is about sort of certain form of self-presentation. I mean, where and how do we sort out what's talking out of a kind of artist persona and what might be more genuine. They do lie quite a lot. Some of them have been caught out at it. So, for instance, go back, to some sort of famous cases about long-dead artists. De Chirico predated many of his paintings in an attempt to sort of show that he was more innovatory than he really was. Miro claimed that many of his surrealist works were automatic paintings done in some sort of, day-long trances. And so he would kind of emerge from this trance and there would be this thing. Of course, the problem of automatic, the problem of painting for surrealists was a sort of a deep one, given their attachment to automatism. You could just about imagine that a drawing might be automatic, but a large painting, this is a problem, right? So this was Miro's answer to that problem, and the art historian David Lomas discovered many preparatory drawings for these things. So he's plainly lying, right, about that, for kind of ideological reasons. Another point, I suppose, is whether the proliferation of interviews is at all interesting. Once an artist had been interviewed maybe five times, do we learn anything more from further kind of publicizing proliferations of these things? So there's an interesting story about Jeff Koons. The Tim Griffin story, which there's an interesting issue of Art Journal, by the way, from fall 2005, I think, which is sort of devoted to the issue of the artist interview, and this is part of that. Griffin thought they'd had a very good exchange. Koons seemed to be very open. He seemed to be telling them all sorts of interesting things. This was something that was supposed to be coming out in Time Out. And then shortly before his interview came out, he opened the New York Times magazine and saw another interview with Koons in which almost exactly the same material had all been reproduced, right? So Koons is here plainly giving a kind of standard, off-the-peg sort of performance for probably many people, at say, you know, over time. And this isn't new either. I mean, I just like these. This is Koons' painted-up BMW. If you read Henry Moore interviews, for instance, it becomes, and again, there are many of those, it becomes very apparent that he has a particular kind of shtick, right? And he will tell us that the interview is the same thing over and over again. And as with many artists, there are many things he won't talk about. Like, he won't talk about contemporaries. He won't talk about his relationships to Hepworth. You know, if he's asked about influences, he always goes back to Michelangelo, all right? For pretty obvious reasons, I think. And it's true also of the Moore photographs. You know, he had his own kind of official photographer. That the way in which he poses with these things, the way in which he presents his image and the work is, you know, carefully considered. So it's not a matter of postmodernism, this. I don't think it's something which goes back a good deal further. Talking to the sculpture assistants who used to work at the, or still work at the Moore Foundation, actually, they were, you know, very amusing about these works, that these photographs that were taken when Moore was in his 80s, where he's standing beside some enormous piece of marble with a, you know, chisel and a hammer. And he's plainly physically incapable of doing that work any longer, which was, in any case, mostly done by Italian craftsmen in Carrara, right? But the pictures tell a different story, a kind of, another kind of lie, if you like. If these artists and I think this is also part of celebrity culture, basically, that, you know, many artists are sort of participating in this, and they you know, they appear within the same kinds of circuits, the same kind of mass media, and that, as is, you know, very familiar, it's a kind of a simulacrum, a hall of mirrors, and I'm not really sure that you know, if these artists and these celebrity statements are ineluctable, I think it's probably because in this realm they're also in a sense contentless. We know as much or as little, in a sense, about Amy Winehouse, maybe Amy Winehouse or Madonna, as we do about Koons or Hearst or Murakami, right? I don't think that, you know, it's a bit like spying, in a sense, you know, the discourse of spying. You can't be sure that any statement that you have is remotely straight. Okay. So in a sense, that in this way, I think it limits the use of these things. Above all, I'll put that up. That's Murakami enjoying himself at in Miami. There's a deeper problem, though, which I think is that artists don't really know what they're doing. They may, in a sense, know what they're doing in terms of how they think of their practice and the techniques of it. And it's, you know, interviews can be useful in illuminating that, I guess. But in terms of making intervention in a wider culture, they don't know what they're doing. We don't know what they're doing either, very often. There's no reason why an artist's opinion about that should be any more valuable than anybody else's. Now, Gilda mentioned an interview with Benjamin Booklow and Warhol, and I want to mention another one, which is an extraordinary interview that he did with Gerhard Richter, I think also in the 80s. Now, this is a magnificent interview, and again, a failure in a certain sense, in that these two are just ships passing in the night. They have very little to say to each other, which kind of connects with the other view. And in fact, there are certain points at which Richter is aghast at Booklow's interpretation of his work as a sort of affectless repetition of, you know, elements of mass culture. A sort of reflection on the impossibility of originality and of making, art making a sort of significant and an original sort of intervention in the scene. Now, for me, Booklow's interpretation of Richter's art is much more interesting than Richter's, and it's a powerful one too, and it has one that has a certain amount of traction, at least for a certain time, I think, in the discourse around that artist. So again, there's no real reason why we should privilege artists' statements about that. It's like the movies or anything else. I mean, you know, there's been some good work done on the success or failure of movies and movie producers. It's clear that from this work, where you can at least, you can quantify these things in market terms, that no one in the movie industry really knows what they're doing. And if the successful producers and directors and actors and so on are merely lucky, okay. So you're basically you're issuing a cultural work into a deeply complex and sort of fractal environment, and how it will be received, you have no idea. And that's as true of artists as it is of anybody else. It's true of writers, too, incidentally. Now, as Gilda mentioned, positions for or against the interview do have historical dimensions, and she also mentioned Avalanche magazine. So it was clear then, I think, that in the 60s, late 60s and early 70s, you know, the interview then was pitched against a very authoritarian, very powerful formalist art criticism. And, you know, it was a weapon against that. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to downplay that. But it's plainly, you know, we do not live in those times. We do not have that kind of criticism. We do, you know, if anything, we might say that art criticism is too weak. And the interview, along with the kind of profile, a linked form, is pretty dominant. Now, some people claim that interviews build dialogue through, build community through a form of dialogue. But as I say, I mean, although there are many variations on the form, the fundamental character of it seems to be unequal, this interviewer-interviewee relation. And it's also usually one-to-one. And it's a broadcast media and form. So I think that the current dominance of artist statements and interviews sort of feeds into a kind of cultic elevation of the artist. And in that sense, I'd like to see it dissolving in a wider, egalitarian, participatory culture. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I understand you both have slightly equivocal positions here for and against, but I think there are lots of points of elision and contradiction. Do you want to pile in, Gilda? There's one surprising point, actually, that I found the reversal of what I expected. You would both want to find in an interview. So your concentration on the idea of truth and lies, of veracity of information that an interview contains, and your delight in the illogicality of an interview. And from what I understand you both do in terms of your own writing, I would have expected that to have been reversed. Do you want to pick up that point about the truth and lies at all?
Well, I spent years transcribing interviews because I worked at Flash Art for 5 years, and I did 10 years at Biden doing their interviews, or I wouldn't translate. And it was always incredible to me that there was the obvious absent center, which is the editor, who is creating the fiction and the transcriber. And I could tell you hilarious stories of things that go in and go out of an interview. Okay, I'm going to tell you one. This is a true story. I transcribed it myself, I know it's true. Raymond Pettibon interviewed Dennis Cooper. Dennis Cooper says to him, Raymond, your work really changes at the end of the 1970s. It goes from being really magazine-y, cartoonish, to something much more serious, much more literary. Did something change? And Raymond says, I heard it myself. Yes, I read the books of Anne Tyler, and they completely changed my perspective on literature. They completely changed my work. So I'm reading this thing, and I'm thinking, really? Anne Tyler changed Raymond Pettibon's life? You know, I thought it was Milton and James. And so I check him on this. You do mean Anne Tyler, accidental tourist in the 70s, really? And I email him. I ask him. He never gets back to me. I finally have him on the phone, and I say, Raymond, you do mean Anne Tyler. Do you have a title? Do you want to add? Do you want to, like, just... He says, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never read Anne Tyler in my life. She's of no interest to me. Stop asking me about Anne Tyler. It means nothing to me. Which, of course, we just took out of the interview and it was gone. That's probably the most interesting thing in the interview, when it disappeared, it's vanished. So that all to say, that, and I could tell you so many more, of moments, the fiction of the interview, I think is something we all need to admit. And there's a sense that we all know that it's a fiction. And that's what artists do. They invent things. We now know, for example, that Warhol did not say half the things he said. Okay, the famous Gretchen Berg interview, where he says, if you want to know everything about Andy Warhol, look at the surface of me and my works, and there's nothing behind it. He never said that. Gretchen Berg said that. And she, as a self-effacing 23-year-old woman, took herself out of the interview and rewrote it and made him say it. Now, that does not take his authorship away. Okay, he stood by it. He loved that interview. He ventriloquized and mimicked the way she created a literary voice for him, really. And he mimicked it and had other people mimic that voice because it was so good. And so there's a growing awareness of the fiction of the interview that I think we all need to kind of admit. And that particular figures, Murakami, Koons, Harris, etc., are particularly good at manipulating that. And the reason Buchlo's did great interviews, and I will, you know, champion him because he's worth it. He's so prepared. You know, he can go head to head with Richter that way because he's as engaged and knowledgeable and interested in Richter's work as Richter is. And so so it's really not a failure, right? I mean, that, and there's the only place for that is an interview. And the Warhol one that I'd like to bring up is where it's 1985. Warhol is a dinosaur, right? He's dead in the water. He's supporting street art. Nobody wants to. He's sold out. Everyone hates him. He's dying, and Buchlo has this interview. He's basically sending him, he's throwing him a life preserver. He's saying, Warhol, you're different. You're better than these guys. You're not like Sally and Fischel and all those guys. You're a conceptualist. You're making fun of that in the Rorschach test and stuff, right? And he's really trying to help Warhol. He's like, Andy, wake up. I'm helping you here. And Warhol will not budge. He's like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I love these guys, Basquiat and Herring, they're all great. And then Buchlo's like, but what about Wiener? Oh, he's great too. Is he doing the same thing? That's great. And he will not take his Warhol off for even 2 minutes, even when he's drowning. And it's an amazing thing. And that ability, that only an interview could do that. You couldn't put that in any other kind of art writing. His commitment to that particular sense of what his purpose is as an artist. And they're wonderful things. I have to say, in Obrist's defense, having commissioned all those books at Feiden, almost every artist, when you ask them, who would you like to interview, would say Hans-Ulrich Obrist. And we had to say no more Obrist, because he can't do all the interviews of horror books. He is extremely beloved, by and large, by artists. I'm sure there are exceptions, but there is something about, he only does interviews, everybody knows that. There are some critics who only do interviews, will not write. Obrist is one of them, Kaspar Koenig is one of them, will not write. Only does interviews.
I have some students. He's some people who write for him.
But he will do interviews. And so I think we can admit the fiction of it, and allow for that as kind of part of the instability of the interview itself. I've worked with Jeff Cole Wall, and he's very, very defensive in interviews, very, very careful. Usually does them in writing and doesn't do face-to-face ones. So I have to agree with your point there. Okay, I think that's my response. But I think we're both really getting at a certain laziness, aren't we? That, you know, that there's a laziness, there's a shortcut about it, whereby you let the artist do all the talking. You do it by email, and those don't work, and those really kill the interview and give it this kind of proliferation that makes it, you know, not with the paper, it's printed on that. There's no question about that.
I mean, I think that I would see that laziness, if that's what you want to call it, as quite a structural feature of the scene. I think that's the problem. And Buchlo, you know, is an extreme outlier in this. As you say, he's fantastically well-prepared, knowledgeable. And not only that, he has very well-developed and thought-through opinions of his own, which he's prepared to, you know, pitch against the ideas of even, you know, very, very famous and well-known artists. But I think that's an extreme rarity, right? And they are absolutely revealing and extraordinary pieces. And I think you're right that the interview is the only place where you would get that kind of confrontation. But the general run of them are very much not like that. And they're tied up with a sort of industry of publicity and celebrity, you know, which I've tried to examine. I think that, and in a sense, this business about logic or the lack of logic and instability, ambiguity, the kind of, you know, is linked up with that proliferation of discourse too. Someone, I think it was Mignon Nixon at the Courtauld, said to me in some frustration about art historical discourse, but it could apply equally to art criticism and to art discourse generally, you know, is no matter ever settled, right? And of course it can't be, right? Because the discourse must continue. In that sense, it's very much unlike science, I guess, one would say. And it has to continue because, you know, we have to continue to fill art magazines, we have to continue to fill art catalogues, we have to continue to, you know, make these texts which are kind of counted by state bodies, you know, for sort of, you know, bean counting assessment exercises for our research and so on. So there's a, you know, there's a very definite link, I think, in academia and outside in the mass media too, between, you know, an ideology of sort of a kind of often fairly lazy postmodern attachment to instability, to deconstruction and so on, and this endless proliferation of publicizing discourse. I can't remember who it was you were talking about in your point about the it was a Catalan and somebody else. Who was that?
Peter Coffin.
That's it. And you were saying at one point that, you know, there are all these statements which were plainly sort of masks and, you know, seemed to come out of a persona. But there seemed to be a point at which, you know, he stepped out from behind all those masks and said something which seemed to come, you know, from the heart or something of that sort.
That's the illusion.
The illusion. As I say, I don't know how you would ever know that. And I think that applies pretty much to any artist interview that you read.
Can I ask you both a question before maybe we hand over to your seconds to open discussion out further? I want to, because you've spoken very much about it from the position of the artist and interviewer, the producer of this material. And how do you, what would you say about the responsibility of the reader towards this information? Because there's a very commonsensual idea that curiosity is good and healthy and a comprehensive understanding of lots of things is to be supported. But then there's the opposing view that this, and you both used, I think, terms like spying and eavesdropping. There's this negative tendency to think of snippets of information as disengaged, as shallow, pond-skating ways of dealing with epistemological content. So what are your hopes for readers of interviews in terms of what they do with the knowledge that can be gleaned from it?
Well, I mean, it makes me think, in a way, also in terms of what you're saying, Julian, is that if the interview began as at the service of the artist, in a way, let's give her a chance to talk, it's the kind of laziness we're talking about is really at the service of a particularly undiscriminating or uninformed reader. You know, that it's a way to extract information very, very easily, and it's the quickest, fastest, most readable way to know everything about an artist because you got it straight from her mouth. And so I think there is a sense that probably like the Buchlow interview. Just let's keep that as our paradigm. You can't just read a bit of it. Okay, you just can't. It's a full text. It's treated like a text, and you have to read it like a text from the beginning to the end. And so I think there is a sense of obligation of a reader, so that, you know, a more attentive reader would certainly be the beneficiary of better interview making, which I think we're kind of suggesting.
I mean, there are plainly many ways to read these things, and I wouldn't want to prescribe one or the other. But I guess, you know, to bear in mind as you read these things that they are the production of a particular kind of industry, and to see them as a part of that. Would be, you know, one step towards, you know, having in mind a critique as you read. But I mean, actually, another thing that Gilda said, which struck me, was that interviews seem to be the place where big ideas are raised. You know,
potentially.
Which, I mean, I think is often true that people kind of punt out these things. But it's isn't that a curiosity in itself that the big issues should be expressed in the most sort of skimpy and insubstantial and sort of skitting of forms? I mean, if you want to address those big issues, go and read something serious. Yeah.
Okay, do you want to call on seconds at all?
Lisa Lefebvre is my colleague at Goldsmiths.
Okay, so I'm here to second the for the interview argument. And I think that Julian's last comment, go read something serious, is very much, I think, indicative of a position that Julian has argued against the interview. I think he is defining the interview as something that's a shallow, non-intellectually significant text that is descriptive, doesn't really get anywhere at all. But to my mind, what you've described, Julian, is the bad artist interview, in the same way as we have the bad critical piece of writing, the bad piece of critical theory. Not all interviews are rigorous. I think that what Gilda has argued for is the status of the artist interview within intellectual discourse around artistic practice. The artist interview is a moment for generative thinking. There are good artist interviews, there are bad artist interviews, but I think as a mode of writing, it really does do something that a piece of monologue writing does not do. The artist interview gives an opportunity for the artist's voice, and the artist we may well see as being a liar, a scammer, and a cheat, but it's still of interest to hear the artist putting that position forward. Secondly, it's this sense of generative thinking. The interview, as Gilda has very eruditely argued, is the product of three people: the artist, the person who the artist is in discourse with, and the editor. And together, those three people create something that is generative thinking. I think that also taps into Julian's comment about unequal power. You mentioned the Buchlo example, where Buchlo was much more interesting than Richter. Great, that's not a problem. I think the artist's interview is not just about the artist's voice, it is about the voice of the person interviewing the artist. The third point that I want to do for seconding the importance of the artist interview is the interview always takes place at a very particular time and place. So when one reads an artist interview, you're performing some kind of time travel that has not kind of been mediated by what Julian described as being some kind of retrogressive fictionalization of the past. So to return to Avalanche magazine, if you read the interviews in Avalanche magazine, you can read, for example, Bruce Nauman struggling with what it is to be an artist at a completely different point from where we recognize his artistic practice now. It's a moment of getting a sense of a particular time and place. So I'd like to second Gilda in that the artist interview is a site for productive intellectual discourse. It is not a site where we read artists not knowing what they're doing. It is not a site where we merely get something that passes for critical discourse. It is a site where we can have something that really does contribute to discourse. And we shouldn't kind of state any claims for the artist interview that are based on poorly researched, badly written interviews, because those are just bad. They're not to denigrate it as a genre of thinking, listening, and articulating sets of ideas.
I'll call on my second, who's Mark Smith, who's editor of Journal of Visual Culture, among other things.
So, Lisa, can you pass the... Thank you. Oh, you have your own microphone.
Is his microphone working, or should he just project?
I can happily start by saying that I'm 100% unconditionally supportive of...
Dr. Julian Stalabrassi's position. And even if I feel slightly ambivalent about saying that in the same way that he does, having done a lot of interviews with artists and academics and having enjoyed the process very much, and as Julian says, working as an editor and being acutely aware of the fact that editors are the most sophisticated curators out there, I nonetheless argue to support Julian's position. I'd like to bring up a couple of things first. The first thing is to say that the interviews, the invention of 19th century journalism, and I think that if we've lost anything since its founding, it's the responsibility that goes along with that, with understanding what it means to conduct interviews. The second thing is to draw attention to the etymology of the interview, which takes us back to the French entrevue, in his best French accent, to see between. You know, and I think that this is key. I mean, I think it's integral to what both Julian and Gilda have been talking about. You know, it's the possibility of interviews generating something above and beyond what the two participants could possibly have imagined in advance. You know, the what Gilda called the third result, which I believe in absolutely, but having carried out extensive research in this area, I can say without conviction that 84% of interviews don't actually do this. That 84% of interviews are actually rubbish and not interesting. And I think that the relationship between interviews and their being interesting is incredibly key. You know, I think Gilda made some of these points. I obviously have to say that Julian made them better. That there are, you know, issues here around preparation, which are absolutely key. I think there are issues around laziness and boredom and masks and facades and lies and more lies and more damn lies that make them way, way less interesting than they should be. I think that artists are as bad as interviewees, and I think that that's a terrible problem in terms of the de-skilling question that was raised earlier on. What else did I want to say? Because I've ended up supporting both, which really wasn't the plan at all, but I'm doing my best to play devil's advocate. Was there one other thing just to get things rolling? The question of where interviews are published, I think, is incredibly key and not something that was raised. You know, there is a difference between, you know, working on an interview for Time Out or Freeze or an academic journal. I think the interviewers and interviewees prepare in very different ways. I think that the way that those interviews are received and read and engaged with are given very different kind of credibility. And I think one just needs to kind of draw attention to the limitations of certain kinds of publications and, you know, the inevitable kind of failure of interviews to do what it is you want them to do as they, you know, enter into the world via something like Freeze, you know, via online deliveries, via blogs and so on and so forth. You know, there is a question of quality which very rarely gets addressed, and, you know, one has to acknowledge a certain dissolving or flattening out of the question of quality, of so many words. I think that was the phrase you were looking for when you were talking about Hans Ulrich. Just, you know, that there are too many words. And if one is going to curate words, you know, one needs to attend to things like quality, to things like being economical about what it is that words do, what words mean and what they have the capacity to do. So I guess in supporting Julian, I'm really saying less interviews, please. Less interviews. Thank you.
Well, thanks to the seconds. We can open it up now to the whole room if anyone would like to pitch in. Okay, I'll start on one question, Julian. I was intrigued by your, I think it was a very sort of brisk outro where you were just reiterating the monolithic celebrity culture aspect that interviewings appear to perpetuate. And you said you'd like to see something in its stead that was more participatory. And is this the internet that you're pointing at here, or is there some other model?
It could be. It could certainly be a part of it. As I say, the interview seems to me to be fundamentally tied up with old media broadcast forms, in a sense. And as I say, there's often, not always, but often this unequal relationship between the two participants, although it's true that Gilda's point about the editor is absolutely right. And, of course, the editor often has considerable power over the way this thing is sculpted and structured and made into a kind of apparently a coherent text. But yeah, indeed, that, you know, one of my main suspicions about it, I suppose, is this privileging of the artist's discourse over, you know, not so much over, you know, process, over, because surely they do have something to say about that, which, you know, because they're the ones who are doing it, right? But when it comes to, you know, reception, to what the work of art does within the world, then I think that anyone's opinion is as valid as anybody else's, and that, you know, the dominance of the interview form is a problem. And as I say, especially because it's not just that interviews sit there, they are then taken up by the critical literature and used very often over and over again, you know, to make, you know, the points that the artist wants to make. So it's a way of the artist, you know, too much, I would say, dominating the discourse about what it is that they're about, and you know, and that's a power relation and one we should be clear about.
Do you want to come in there and maybe talk about, your point about at the very beginning about there's something being beyond the text that's being discussed, and it makes me think of stained glass windows where you can read the picture, or the coloured light can behave in a more sort of sensory rather than a narrative way. Is there something in that dual nature of the text that could be that could be used in refutation of that didacticness of the artist that Julian's talking about?
Well, one thing we haven't touched upon is the potential of the interview for parody and there are a lot of interviews that are fake interviews, you know, like Maurizio Cattelan taking an interview, Angeletta's interview, and making it his own, and others, and reversals. And there's a great interview that Jimmy Durham wrote called "The Interview with the 10,000-Year-Old Artist." Does anyone know this text? It's wonderful, where he's talking about the interview with the 10,000-year-old artist, and it's sort of a parody of himself as, you know, Native American Indian. He must be 10,000 years old. And it's very funny, you know, about his place as in marginal culture. And he has lines like, they asked the 10,000-year-old artist, well, what were things like, you know, 10,000 years ago? And he says, well, it was really hard. You know, there weren't that many artists, and there weren't that many galleries. Well, no galleries you'd want to show in. And he just goes on like that. And it's very, very funny. It's very, very, he uses the interview as a format, as a structure, to get at another kind of critique. So I think there are ways in which that kind of manipulation actually can be taken advantage of in interesting ways that use that particular format, that recognizability of the Q&A, and the ease of reading it that are used. By the way, I mean, I think there's something that the 84% statistic that I loved, but you could do that with anything, right? 84% of all reviews are 84% of the art we see and overall are probably not, is not probably that. You know, so there's a kind of sense that, you know, getting at the good and the great of any of our, the forms that we're all working with is rather rare, and we're all kind of waiting for it, including the interview, I think.
Also, 84% of people love statistics as well.
Do you know, can I make an argument on your side, which I thought which was something, is the there's a kind of defensiveness in the art world of taking your position. And it's certainly when, again, when I was editing at Fiden, there's no question that the artist, the part of the book they were most interested in was the interview. In fact, many of the artists really weren't interested in the whole rest of the book. But what they said, which is natural, we're all want, you know, what comes out of our mouths, we want it to be carefully phrased. And there was a lot of defensiveness of, oh no, get rid of that because that makes me look a little funny. There was a lot of this sort of censoring, improving, facelifting that goes on in the interview. And I think that's a place where that takes place more than many other kinds of text. So I would give you a bit of ammo, because I think it's a defensive place where artists has to stake a position, which is not necessarily part of their practice or really very worth doing.
Although this is certainly true, but it's also true, which we ought to acknowledge about art discourse as a whole, that especially if you're looking for picture rights and things like that, you know, very often there's oversight over the text that accompanies those pictures. And there are artists or dealers or people who are managing artists' estates who are asking for changes in those texts. And, you know, they appear invisibly, generally. So, you know, you're not aware of this kind of defamation of discourse. With High Art Light, this book I did about young British art, we got to the stage where I had to reproduce kind of blanks instead of images because there was a dealer who didn't like what he read. And refused to, you know, to let us have the pictures. So there, at least, I suppose it was visible for once. But it's usually invisible. There's power relations.
Any questions or comments from the floor? We're going to have to go home shortly. Yeah, we have one by there. Can you pass the roving mic? Thanks.
Hello. Yes. In terms of talking about the quality of the interview. You mentioned that the interview. Sorry,
Julian.
Sorry, yeah. You mentioned that the interviewer was more interesting than the person being interviewed, and there was a problem with how artists express themselves or are unable to express themselves any better than anybody else about the work that they're making. At the moment, from a conceptual point of view, do you not think that that's a problem in a more general, wider sense? Because from personal experience, and this might be a bit of a pithy remark, but I've been to a few private views where you've seen artists, you know, description of their work, and it's, you know, it's incredibly dull and bland and doesn't explain anything and doesn't even sound like they know what they're writing about. So is that a wider problem for art at the moment in general, or do you know what I mean?
Obviously there's a huge variation in the articulacy and the kind of thoughtfulness of artists, and many of course, you know, perhaps as a persona even, come across of course, Warhol was a sort of famous case, inarticulate and kind of a blank. I mean, that can be one sort of strategy. The Richter Booklow interview is extraordinary because these are both incredibly intelligent and articulate people. But I think the point I was making was simply that you know, there would be a tendency in much art world discourse to privilege Richter's view of what Richter was doing over any critics. And I think, you know, that's a particularly clear case for me where, you know, the critic's view is much more interesting, possibly more accurate than the artist's view of what he's doing. Of course, these things, you know, when you talk about accuracy in this case, again, both are coming from ideological positions and are trying to create a reality, an interpretation around the work. And in more recent years, we've seen a very different view of Richter's work emerging, where he is held up as this kind of visionary genius, bizarrely, by the Museum of Modern Art and Robert Storr and so on. So, you know, it's always a struggle for, you know, a particular view. But as I say, I don't think, you know, one thing that I think the interview tends to do, but it's built into the ideology of the art world very, very deeply, despite all the kind of lessons we are supposed to have learned from postmodernism, is that the artist's view of their work is somehow a privileged one.
I'd like to say that going back to the Warhol thing, is that actually when you read his interviews, if you read them all, you realize how intelligent and articulate and funny he was. I mean, you get a side of his work. There's so many examples. There's a wonderful, how he would take control of things through humor and so forth. I mean, there's a great interview that starts where the interviewer says, "Andy, now I know you're working on two films and you've got a gallery show coming, but I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the private Andy, the outside of the factory Andy. What? Tell me about that." And Warhol says, "Yes, that's right. I'm working on two films. The first one is blah, blah, blah," and he goes on like that. And he's also very funny. I mean, I hope you'll find this funny. He's talking about the work he's doing. He's taking these pictures on a beach, and he's talking about the beach. And the interviewer says, "Really? You're on a beach? What do you wear on the beach?" And Warhol says, "I wear an umbrella." And on and on and on. And he's very fast, and he says a lot of funny things. And he's very quick. And this idea that he's a bit of a dullard goes when you read his interview, because you realize how quick he is in having comments and responses, and all of the performance of the is a performance. I mean, he really discloses it, because it's obvious that he's anything but stupid.
Come on, participatory culture.
Kate, tell us we're wrong.
Was that a hand I saw back there? Oh, here at the front, please. Yeah, not to put the pressure on, but I agree that articulacy is not about a surfeit of words, but the accuracy of where they land. Over to you, Johnny.
What do both of you make of artists who decidedly don't give interviews? I would imagine on Jill's side, you'd probably put that in the bracket of performative activity. It's a performance to maintain silence, and maybe Julian would think of that as an exercise of the power of silence as a way of kind of controlling a discourse. Both of those perspectives, without putting words in your mouth, but might feel a bit negative, but are there examples of critical writing where the silence of decided, choice silence of an artist around interviews produces generative text in those who are left with that silence?
Well, I have a very literal example of that, which was doing a book on Anquara for Fiden. And Anquara, as you know, does not do interviews, never has. Leaves no mark of his physical existence to the extent, and he really means it, by the way, he wouldn't sign the contract for the book, et cetera, et cetera. He really will leave no mark. He's not kidding about that. It's wonderful to meet him, by the way, because he has no phone calls. He just talks to you. He's got none of those distractions. And because the book had a certain format, which starts always with an interview, we had to get around that and decided to create this kind of tribute in which people who know him, have worked with him, who he nominated, would write short texts about whatever they wanted, really, an experience, memory, or a work of art. Kasper Koenig wrote one, Bob Nickus wrote others, et cetera, et cetera. So there are ways around it. And I think that's part of a conceptual practice in that case, and so it's very coherent, obviously. But there's other people, like I don't think Inkier, for example, has ever given an interview. I think that would contradict, I don't know if he's chosen not to give any, but I was actually looking for one and noticed there are none. I think there would be contradict his practice that he's not really interested in pinning down meaning in the work. If you go to talk to him, as I have, he'll tell you what he's thinking about when he's making the work, the kinds of books, it's not about that kind of pinning down of meaning, and I suspect that the interview, which he seems to be avoiding, would contradict that. So I think there are ways in which not having being an interview is part of the practice, and that, you know, that's worth kind of commenting on too.
I think ideally one would hope that for artists who refused to talk about their work, that it would in fact, you know, liberate the discourse around it, and you would get a greater proliferation and variety of interpretations. I'm not sure that actually happens. It would be very interesting to look, actually, to see whether that's the case. And I do know of some cases of artists who, you know, famously don't talk, where certainly academics are kind of wary of treading into that territory because they're not sure whether they're going to get any kind of special access. You know, they're a bit frightened by it, I think, by that very freedom, which speaks indeed to the ideology of, you know, this powerful ideology of, you know, the power of the author as originator.
I wanted to pick up on Gilda's last comment about the Ankhuwara, because I thought that was a really interesting thing to have done for that publication, because in a way it led me to think about the anecdote, because it sounds like you ended up getting a series of anecdotes from a group of people to constitute some kind of equivalent or analogy to the interview. And I thought that was just a really nice thing to have done. So my question is about the anecdote, because one of the great things about artist interviews or interviews generally is that you get an anecdote. There is something that the artist says or the academic says in an interview that you probably would never have come across in any other form. So it is a little bit about eavesdropping or spying. There's something, you know. So I would like you to, both of you, to talk about the anecdote and the anecdote either in relation to the interview or the anecdote in relation to art criticism or academic scholarly writing, and the function of the anecdote, pro and against, and I don't mind who says what about it.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's something I actually would have liked to talk about, is rather than anecdote, could I use the word storytelling, which is what I think comes up a lot in interviews. And there's something, there's something about, a lot of interviews start with, tell me about what you're doing as a student, okay? And they turn it into that kind of narrative. And why is that? What storytelling has to do that? And I remember talking to David Batchelor, the art critic and artist, about art writing, not in terms of interviews in this, and saying to him something like, oh, why is so much art writing so dull? And he says, because there's no storytelling. There's no, if you read Freud, he stops everything to tell the story, and you're interested. If you read Marx, he stops and he tells you a story, and he gets you back into it. And I think David Batchelor tries to do that and does so rather well. And it's a very difficult thing without becoming stupid and just a digression. But there is a moment of storytelling which it makes writing much more engaging, even other kinds of political writing, any kind of writing. If you're so skillful, you can work that in, which the interview does offer the fiction of that kind of storytelling. And I think it is probably rare that way in art writing, that kind of readability through stories, anecdotes, takes place.
Yeah. They're attractive shortcuts into something, I think, aren't they? You know, there's plainly, you know, the anecdote is a kind of a mini story, but often one, you know, if it works, it's supposed to be one which is telling about a wider situation, and it's a kind of quick way of into a subject or into an artist's work. I don't know. There was a guy who's art critic of The Guardian for a while, who wrote almost entirely in anecdotes. And it was extraordinary. It's like he has this kind of encyclopedia of anecdotes. Any artist, you know, you could think of, it would always be the same stories rolled out again and again and again, of course. You know, when they're fresh, you know, they may... I'm not against them. I think they have a use. But I don't think they're necessarily tied to the interview form either.
But that's where you often get them.
Yeah.
So you read an interview about an artist, you have an anecdote, and then you can start an academic article with that anecdote that somehow enables you to talk about other kind of conceptual themes related to the artist's work or related to whatever discourses that you're looking at.
So, yeah.
You know, it's a nice way, like Bryony Fur does it brilliantly. She's just great at using the anecdote. So you're kind of outside
and you're being seduced. It's a seduction as well, being seduced to then open up. So,
yeah. Okay, unless we have any more questions, or we do. Here we go.
Microphone. Cheers, thank you. Hi, could I just say to Julian, under what conditions would you yourself do an interview? And do you have a kind of ideal reader?
Well, as I say, I have done them. Mostly with photographers, although I also interviewed Michael Landy. I think I'd support a lot of what Gilda said towards the end of her presentation about, I think these things can be good. It's a matter of hopefully, preparation on both sides, some kind of sympathetic engagement. I think if you can ask probing and critical questions and you have an artist who is prepared to answer them, then great. But it's often not the case. And then, of course, in terms of your ideal reader, well, this very much depends on where the interview is appearing. And I think that, both as an interviewer and often an editor as well of the resulting text, you can't make generalizations about that. I think that it's very much to do with, is it appearing in an academic journal? Is it appearing in a monographic catalogue or what?
But the framing of it seems quite important for you because I think you kind of underestimate a reader. Or you want to direct a reader very much and not allow for that, for something to, I don't know, for a kind of confusion just to be, it's just to be interesting, or for lies to exist, or for, I don't know, half-truths.
Well, you absolutely, you don't know, as I say. I mean, this is one of the fundamental things about it. You don't know the status of the responses that you're getting, and the reader doesn't know status of the responses that the questions that you ask either, or the statements that you make. I don't know that. I suppose in editing interviews, I do try to, by moving texts around, by maybe asking for elaborations, by cutting bits out as well. You try to create a text which, has a cogency to it, and perhaps something of an unfolding narrative too. So it's a matter of helping and engaging a reader, not necessarily though of preempting their responses. I mean, you can't really do that because it's unlike a text that you write yourself. You don't know what's going to be said back to you, so.
I think that's important. I think that there's a sense that in an interview, doing an interview, you can forego all the sort of niceties and that you need to write any kind of text. That you don't need your language is much more simple. The organization does not need to be carefully thought through. A thesis and a counter. When in fact, good interviews all have those same qualities that usually, accompany any kind of writing.
Response to that question, if that's all right. I think part of the concern is what people go on to use interviews for. So I'm not against lies or bullshit or misdirection or anecdotes or anything that might be kind of fabricated in one way or another. It's about what happens to that material when it's understood as being accurate, whatever that might mean, and then goes on to support an argument, to affirm a claim, to justify this, that, and the other. And I think, in terms of kind of how one goes about reading interviews critically, I'm just going back to what Gilda was saying about, Warhol having a sense of humour. The way you hear an interview as you read it has a huge effect on how you go on to use it. And if you don't hear the humour, or if you hear the humour but decide to ignore it, and use that material for other ends, there are consequences. And I think it's just, very kind of, somber, comment about the importance of being wary of the consequences of how one takes advantage of interviews.
I mean, one of the things about being able to watch that interview is that we see he's laughing through half of it, And, of course, once you transcribe it, it just becomes no, yes, no.
No.
When...
I put a collection of interviews together and had really interesting conversations with all of the interviewees about whether or not they left their laughter in. Mm. And it was a huge deal. You know, there are all kinds of ways in that word, you know, laughter in brackets, kind of, you know, lets you hear the interview in the so-called right way. People who take it out, you know, they're generally dry. You know, it's kind of interesting. They don't want a reader to be told that they're being funny. They want the reader to be smart enough, in inverted commas, you know, to hear the laughter. So, yeah.
Okay, well, we're overflowing our vessel of time, okay. I'm afraid. And not wanting to raise the hand of a victor in the air. I think you've both sustained just a few flesh wounds. No, no mortal injuries or body blows. So I think just thank you very much, Gilda Williams and Julian Salabras, and their seconds.